Love that. Hey, we're 51 years old today. How exciting is that? I don't know about you, but if you're over 50, which I am just a little bit, I was 2 when the church started, but when I got to 50, I didn't want to celebrate anymore, you know? So why do we get so excited about celebrating 51 now? You know, that we're getting old, right? No. Not in church life. In church life, we celebrate every year we can get because churches don't last forever like ours has for 51 years. It's been great. Lots of lives have been changed. Ton of ministries happened. God has been faithful for so many years. It's so exciting to see all that he's done. A couple of highlights from last year, just in the last year, things that God did that made me go, wow. And there's a ton. So if I'm excluding a ministry you were involved in, why didn't you mention that? I'm sorry. I know I've already left you out. But we reimagined what kids' ministry could look like last year. And the fruit of that is amazing. I talk to people every week who actually come to our church because of our kids' ministry. They don't necessarily like the preaching or the singing and the things we do in here, but their kids love our church, so guess what? In fact, I told the newcomers last night at newcomers dinner, hey, if you haven't decided yet if Werribee Baptist Church is the church for you, and you haven't sent your kids to Kids Men yet, don't. Because once you send your kids to Kids Men, then you're hooked, you have no option, you're going to be here. So that's one thing that we really celebrated last year as we reimagined that. On the other end of the spectrum, we started a Connect Chapel once a month on Wednesdays Wednesday mornings at 11 o'clock once a month to minister to people who like a little more traditional type of service. And we reached out to them and have connected with them, and they are loving that service. And it's actually a beautiful thing to see people from every generation being able to worship in context that makes sense to them and that they can enjoy. Last year, we sent missionaries out. We sent Lisa Adams to a country in South Asia, which I won't mention because it'll be on the podcast. And we sent the Blazies out, and we received the Blazies back, and we celebrated those things. Not as exciting for most of you, but extremely important. One of the most important things that we've done in the last couple of years. Last year, we wrote a new constitution, adopted a new constitution, which changed our governance structure, which set us up as a church for hopefully the next 25 years into the future. Lots of things to celebrate. I was meeting with our staff in our monthly staff meeting this past Thursday, and my week was crazy, settling back in, getting caught up on all the things that happened, and then there was extra meetings outside of the church, and I was feeling drained already by Thursday, and I looked at them, and I told them, I'm tired of being distracted with a lot of things and all that don't matter as much. I said, can you please tell me some good news stories? And I had a big agenda for the morning, lots of other things to do with the team. But over the next 30 minutes, they told me good news stories. And it was exciting to hear about our kids ministry. And our kids ministry leaders was the focus when Alex was sharing that, how they are just ministering above and beyond what could be expected, and that they have adopted and owned all that stuff we reimagined last year. And that's going great, and they're bursting at the seams over there. Actually, they're probably going to force a decision sometime, I don't know if it's this year or not, but to go to 2 services because they can't handle the number of kids, even if we could take a few more adults in here. So be ready for that. Don't be anxious about it, because we should be anxious about nothing. But that was exciting. It was exciting to hear that the youth group this year, the first 4 weeks of this year, has basically doubled from last year. Yeah. Lots of new kids coming in, hearing about faith for the first time, hearing about Jesus and exploring faith with our leaders. And we have such a committed crew of leaders in that space. Abby is more than just a little bit excited about our youth today. It was awesome to hear that the best playgroups in Wyndham, and that's not by our testimony, that's by the council's testimony and everybody on the street, the best playgroups in Wyndham happen right here in our community. And they're all full. We started the year with full playgroups. There's a waiting list of 6 families right now waiting for playgroups. And that was exciting to hear how those are growing, because most of those, about 80% of those, are not church people. Those are ministering to people in our community. I said there's a waiting list of 6 families. Do you know that's a whole nother playgroup? Could be, if we had enough volunteers to run that. So stick that in the back of your mind. If you want to volunteer to help run playgroups, let Karen Gearing know or Sharon know, and we'll hook you up with that. It's exciting to hear how our ministries in the community are connecting people to the church and faith. Heard about a playgroup mom who's been coming to playgroup for years and years and hasn't been involved in the churches, is now connected to a Bible study that some of our ladies run. That's exciting. Yeah, you can clap. That's great. It's exciting to hear from Mark Wilkinson, our chaplain at Wyndham Park Primary School, where we also have 17, I think it is now, Kids Hope Mentors, and how all of that's connecting and now integrating, and that they actually know that it's the church that's actually doing that, that we are sending those people into our community, and that they're appreciating what we're doing. We sent a group of teenagers and leaders over there to do a project in January over the summer, Summer Works program, and the maintenance people were just so thankful and elated that we had participated in that. Got to hear about our Base Camp ministry. That's a ministry that offers respite to people with kids with disability and even young adults with disabilities, and part of their camps now, a couple of times, they've actually included church, coming to church as part of camp. How cool is that? Yeah. And one of the young ladies was sitting in the vision room and actually asking questions about the message that was going on. I was talking about Jesus, and I'd mentioned God, and the person said, "Hey, I believe in God, but I don't know about this Jesus thing. Do you?" And was able to start to talk through some of that with her. These are all new things that are happening. Exciting to see our ministries, our bridge ministries, actually integrating with our church ministries. After about a half an hour of that, I threw my agenda away for our staff meeting, and I just got blessed. My heart was so blessed and full from that meeting. Then last night at our newcomers meeting, I always love to catch up with new people and hear about their journey and what's bringing them along, why they ended up at Werribee, and hear their responses to all the kinds of ministries I just told you about. It's just something that we really need to be thankful. God has done so much in the last 51 years. Can I just say, WBC 51 looks really good on you. It's great. It's great. Looks young. It looks vibrant. When I see what God has done here, my biggest question is honestly, why in the world would not everyone in our community want to be a part of what's going on here? I cannot understand that. My conclusion is this: they must not know about it. That's your job. That's my job. To make sure they know that God's at work at Werribee Baptist Church. Invite somebody to come along next week. Hey, one person that has been impacted from a little kid, well, maybe not too little kid, and he I don't know how little he was even then, but for about 35 years ago, roughly, came to this church, wants to share with you through testimony what this church has meant in his life.
I arrived at this church 1985 in January. I love the local church, and the local church is super important to me. This church has been through many different changes, and a lot of them have helped form who I am. We had a pastor, John Evans. He came in the first night to youth group, and we asked him, what should we call him? And he said, you can call me PJ, which was Pastor John. And so for a kid when you're growing up, and everyone was Mr. and Mrs., so don't forget the 80s. I know some people weren't born then. But the 80s, we called everyone Mr. and Mrs. And for a pastor to say, call me PJ, it was, for a teenager, it was a big thing. PJ always was encouraging and letting us do all the crazy things we wanted to do. We'd strip all the chairs out. We'd put in fruit bins, tip them upside down and nail the trestle tables to the top of that and create a stage and do concerts or worship services and all sorts of crazy stuff. I have no idea what PJ did or didn't do with the elders and the deacons and whether they complained or not, but we had a fantastic time growing up. Have we ever told you about that? Bitoloni and Squamish ball. I once got smashed in a tackle by Anissa Croxon and Esther McNamara. They laid me out flat on the ground. It was like a version of kill or deal with a pill. You get the ball, you tackle them as hard as you can. Anyway, you're not allowed to play that at youth group now. It's a bad game. We had 150 people going to Youth Alive rallies from a small church of, I don't know if it was any bigger than 120 or 150 at the time. Our church, through that time, the class of the 80s and the early 90s, we have several missionaries. You've got pastors and senior pastors, Christian counselors, and awesome teachers, all of which these people are now influencing other churches and other groups of people. I guess as I've gotten older, leaders in the church are super important to me. And so if we as leaders in the church can provide a place that is encouraging to the next generation and encouraging to those who come along, that's what I've seen exampled to me in this place. And that's what I think is super important to have happen. We may find things that I don't like or we don't like, and our tendency is possibly to complain, but good leaders try to be the best they can be and also try to open up and try and allow the church to, and the young people and the new people in the church to be part of the church, to then grow the church. Do it the best we can. Make it relevant and make it fun. Keep it real and keep it true to God's word and what Jesus taught us. Love others and love, love the community as well. Throw the ball at me then. Local church is the hope of the world. Let's do everything we can to lead people to Jesus.
I want to say, that's the kind of impact that WBC has had on people's lives over the years. And now he's one of our council members. Wow. You can evaluate how effective our ministry is on your own. Hey, today we are not only celebrating our 51st anniversary or birthday, and we'll have cake afterwards, and there's no calories in the cake. If you're tracking on an app like I am, don't track it because it doesn't matter today. But we're also wrapping up our One series. The last 4 weeks, Sharon and Justin and Mark have been speaking into the book of 1 Corinthians, the first three chapters, which deal with the theme of unity and how we can become one, how we can become a united church instead of an untied church. And I want to thank them for the input that they have given already and really set things up for me just to kind of wrap it up and put a bow on it here today. Paul is writing to bring some correction in the church because wickedness that was in the city had infiltrated the church, and the church actually no longer looked much different than the society outside the church. And that was a problem. And besides the rampant immorality that we're going to start talking about next week when we start a new series called Christians Behaving Badly, there was something else that had crept in, and it was a propensity within the church for them to elevate one leader over another. It was a propensity to choose teams. I'm going to align with Paul. I'm going to align with Apollos. I'm going to align with Peter. That's the language that Paul uses in the first four chapters, talking about them choosing teams. Most of you know, I just got back from 3.5 weeks in the U.S. where I was originally from. And I saw this being played out in society there, because they're in an election year, and there's lots of drama around that because they over-dramatize everything there, and it was interesting to see the division in the country. It was interesting to see not only division in the country between one political party and another, but within a political party. And I'll name it, the Democratic Party is the one that they would be the opposition right now. They're the ones that are not in power. And they're trying to figure out who they're going to run against Donald Trump. And I'm not advocating for anyone. I think it's all a mess. But anyway, the Democratic Party is fighting amongst themselves. They are trashing each other, all of the potential candidates, and talking about how awful each other are, rather than uniting around a mission and a vision of their own. And what that's going to probably lead to is ineffectiveness. And there are going to be a group of people who will accomplish nothing good because they're spending all of their time fighting with each other rather than focusing on the mission and the vision that they should have. Now, choosing teams is not always a bad thing. If you're here in Australia and you haven't yet chosen a footy team, then you shouldn't be in Australia. I'm sorry. I'm just going to say it like that. You have to do that. And it's a bit of fun. We all like the Bombers here, right? Yes. Hallelujah. Praise God. Amen. A few Cats fans, maybe. Yeah. Golf clap. Right, right. And a couple of Bulldogs fans, maybe. Right. And then the others. Right, right, right. Because we are in the West, and we need to be allegiant to at least the West. But that's where that choosing teams kind of needs to stop. Because we're not going to get in fights and arguments and try to throw each other out because we like the Bombers or the Cats or the Bulldogs, right? What? Was that a Bombers fan, I hope? Hey, one of the greatest enemies to unity is choosing teams, following people, and it's expressed through competing, comparing, criticizing, and condemning. And my friends, those things should never, ever be a part of the church. Never. They are divisive rather than unifying. They will cause us to become untied rather than united. In 1 Corinthians 4, we see Paul bringing to conclusion a conversation that he's been having for the first three chapters about division in the church that was centering around them, elevating one leader over another. The Corinthians were not the first to do this. If we go to the Old Testament, the Jewish scriptures that the Jews lived by, when they were wandering in the wilderness, we have an account in the book of Numbers, which was written by Moses, chapter 14, the book of Numbers. We see them wandering in the wilderness, and they were getting a bit tired. In verse 2, it says, their voices rose up in a great chorus of protest against Moses and Aaron. And they start saying they wish they had died in Egypt and on and on and those things. And then in verse 4, it says, then they plotted among themselves, let's choose a new leader and go back to Egypt. Then Joshua and Caleb, who were a couple of the spies that had just went and spied out the land and came back, and they were saying, hey, let's go, let's go. Well, they said it again. They said, hey, we can take the land. God is with us. So their response to Joshua and Caleb was this in verse 10. It says, the whole community began to talk about stoning Joshua and Caleb. The Israelites were ready to get rid of their leaders. They didn't like the leaders that they had because the message the leaders were giving was not what they wanted to hear. And the circumstances they were living in were not necessarily what they had envisioned and dreamed for their life. There was a bit of suffering going on. Listen to what God told Moses. God told Moses, I will destroy them with a plague, then I will make you into a nation greater and mightier than they are. When I read that, I thought, what if I was Moses? How would I respond to that? Say, all right, yeah, cool, these people are idiots, and God's going to make me a great nation now. It's not what Moses did. Moses was more spiritual than I was. He advocated for the people, and he advocated for God. He said, God, if you do that, that's going to disgrace your name. Don't do that. So the Corinthians weren't the first ones to do this. They weren't the last ones either. I went to a church in back in 2007. Most of you know a little bit of our story. We came to Australia in 2001. We worked in a couple of different church plants. And then we went back to the U.S. because one of our really strong supporting churches back in the U.S. had called and asked me to come back on the pastoral team there. And when I went, a month into it, one of the elders said to me, Stan, we didn't tell you this before you came because you wouldn't have come. But we brought you in to push out the other leader. Yeah, so I'd taken our family, left Australia to go and minister where I thought it was going to be a great thing. And they had an agenda to get rid of the other leader. Long story short, 2 years later, we had ran out the church mafia, and that leader finished well many years later in retirement. But we didn't. So anyway, it's a very long story short. See, the Corinthians had allowed themselves to fall into the trap of comparing one leader with another. They were choosing sides. We'll see later in the book of Corinthians, this was a common thing for them to compare. They compared spiritual gifts and lots of other things that we'll look at later. They were criticizing Paul for his preaching. And we know that because in chapter 2 and 3, we can see a couple times Paul gives evidence of this because he says, I came to you with plain speech. I chose to only preach Jesus to you. I chose to let the Holy Spirit do the work there because you were too immature to handle anything else. But then he defends himself a little bit. He says, and when I've preached to other people who are more mature than you, I can go deeper. So they were saying, we prefer Apollos' preaching. Now, we don't know much about Apollos' preaching. Maybe it was deeper. Maybe he used stories and things like that to help them apply. We don't know. What we do know is Paul didn't engage in debating about whether he was better than Apollos or not. In fact, in chapter 3, verse 5, he simply said this. He says, we both did the work God gave us to do. That was Paul's conclusion. He said, you guys are trying to choose one over the other, but we both just did the work that God gave us to do. That's the bottom line. You shouldn't be worried about who's better at this or who's better at that. We both just did the work God gave us to do. Paul was hurt, and he speaks from his hurt in chapter 4 to teach them. He speaks as a loving father to them who wants to give them a warning about their pride, about their party rivalry that was going on. He wanted to help them move beyond competing and comparing. He wanted them to not become a church that was going to be untied, but a church that was going to be united. That is Paul's passion as we read the words that he says here in 1 Corinthians 4. And he uses he himself and Apollos really just as an illustration to confront their pride. Look at verse 6. It says, dear brothers and sisters, I have used Apollos and myself to illustrate what I've been saying. If you pay attention to what I have quoted from the scriptures, you won't be proud of one of your leaders at the expense of another. You guys, Corinthians, Paul's saying, you're proud, you're arrogant, and now you're trying to promote one leader over another, and that's because you're going to get what you want from this leader or that leader and all those things. You have agendas in that. It's your own pride that is making you do that. And I'm using Apollos and I'm throwing us out here, basically throwing ourselves under the bus for you to show you how that's wrong. And he goes on, and at the beginning of the chapter, he identifies several characteristics that defined his and Apollos' ministry. And we need to take note of that, and that's how we need to measure our own ministries. In verse 1, he says, so look at Apollos and me as mere servants of Christ who have been put in charge of explaining God's mysteries. Now, a person who is put in charge as a manager must be faithful. First and foremost, Paul's saying, hey, leaders are just servants of Christ. We are servants of Christ. A servant, the word servant there literally means an under rower. And it was taken from the imagery of a ship. And at the bottom of the ship, in the bottom of the ship, you had benches with oars that were sticking in. And the servants, the slaves, would actually be the ones that were rowing from down there. Now, down there, it was dirty, filthy, nasty. You can imagine what it would be like on a ship. They're out there for weeks, months, maybe at a time, and no toilet facilities and on and on. I don't need to describe it more. They're down in the stuff, okay? And they're rowing hard. Paul says, we are under rowers. We are serving Christ. Christ is the captain, and we are just rowing as hard as we can in the direction that he is giving us to go. That's what our job is. Paul said, you're elevating us, both of us. Even though you're trying to choose between us, you're elevating both of us, and really, we're just servants. Servants of Christ take direction from him. And the way that normally is played out in our lives is right here amongst each other, with each other, serving one another, not always having to be first, not always having to have the best thing for me, not always having to go with what I want instead of what you want. We serve one another. We also serve others in menial tasks. Like in the church, we talk about setting up chairs and picking up rubbish, making the coffee sometimes, maybe cleaning a toilet occasionally. If you want to put it in a home context, maybe it's doing the dishes or making the bed or doing the floors when it's not necessarily your job or your turn, although who knows whose job it is anyway. If it needs done, it's everybody's job, right? So Paul's point is, first and foremost, we are servants of Christ. Then he says this, he says, leaders are stewards of God's grace. He says, we have been put in charge. We are stewards. That's the word stewards, put in charge. A manager of a household. It's a servant with significant responsibility. Great illustration of this can be found in the Old Testament book of Genesis in the life of Joseph. Joseph was a Hebrew slave in Potiphar's house. He had been sold. Potiphar owned him, and Potiphar owned just about everything else you can imagine, everything he wanted. He was a very wealthy man, but Joseph was a steward. Joseph was in charge of everything Potiphar owned. He owned nothing for himself, but he took care of all of it for Potiphar. He used it wisely for Potiphar. Paul is saying, we are servants, but in that role, we have a stewardship. That stewardship, he says, is explaining God's mysteries. We are explaining God's mysteries. We are stewards of the divine mysteries of God. Now, he very likely is talking about the preaching again. He says, Apollos preaches and I preach. We are divine stewards of the mysteries of God that he reveals through his word. And we're trying to bring those to you. Paul says, we have a huge responsibility to be stewards of the mystery. You know what the mystery is? The mystery is God's grace. Think about it. That's the greatest mystery known to mankind. Why God would look down on us, sinful people who reject him, and say, I'm going to give my only son to die for their sins so they can have a relationship with me. I don't understand that. As a father, I could never do that. Give us one of my kids for the likes of you and people out there. And that just doesn't make sense unless we have the filter of grace. That is the great mystery that they were stewards of. They were stewards of God's grace. God gave us grace. We are stewards of grace. We must share that with others. We need to not just be depositories of grace, but we need to be dispensers of grace. That's what Paul was saying, and that's what we need to understand for us as well today. He continues on. We're servants, and we're to faithfully steward what we've been given. So, in verse 3, as for me, it matters very little how I might be evaluated, read in, judged by you or by any human authority. I don't even trust my own judgment on this point. My conscience is clear, but that doesn't prove I'm right. It's the Lord himself who will examine and decide. See, as stewards, we need to understand who we're responsible to and who we need to be taking direction from. Here, Paul is taking on the issue at hand, the fact that they were judging him. He says, I don't take your judgment of me too seriously. He says, I'm serving Christ. He's the boss. When you criticize me, I cannot allow that to let me lose focus of my stewardship. I have a responsibility, I have a stewardship, and your criticism of me can't get me off track. Conversely, he could be saying as well, if you're complimenting me, if you're telling me how great I am, I've got to be careful not let that go to my head, because I've got a stewardship and I can't get distracted by my own agendas and my own power and all those things that might come along if I'm doing that great a job. It doesn't mean that there's never value in receiving feedback, both positive and negative. It helps us grow. I think it was Billy Graham who said, who was the first one that was recorded as saying, make your critics your coaches. When you hear someone criticize you, they say something to you, whether they say it nice or not, maybe they're an enemy, it doesn't matter. Listen, and if there's a kernel of truth in it, take that on and apply it and say, thank you. You just helped me grow. The other stuff, it doesn't matter if they're criticizing you. No, that's rubbish. That's not true. I can let that go. The cynic philosopher Antisthenes used to say this, There are only two people who can tell you the truth about yourself: an enemy who has lost his temper, and a friend who loves you dearly. Make your critics your coaches. Then Paul says, I'm not taking your judgment of me too seriously. I don't even judge myself because I might be wrong. I don't even judge myself because I might be wrong. See, when we judge ourselves, we're given to one of two extremes. Either we're going to judge ourselves too softly, or we're going to judge ourselves too harshly. And I don't know where you fit in that spectrum of things. We probably all do both from time to time. I like to think I'm a harsh judge of myself, and I'm always too critical of myself. But if I'm honest, I probably am too generous sometimes about judging myself. Our judgment of ourselves can be clouded with self-satisfaction, and our pride can look at that and cause us to misjudge ourselves. Generally speaking, though, we are never as bad as we think we are, and we are never as great as we think we are. We're somewhere else. So Paul says, I'm probably going to get it wrong myself, so I don't even judge myself. He says, God is the one who is the rightful judge. God is the one. I'm going to leave that to God. I'm not going to listen to your judgment of me. I'm not going to listen to my own. I'm going to listen to God's. See, because when we judge, we have a filter. God doesn't have a filter. He knows all the circumstances. We are limited in what we know about certain situations. We need to understand we don't always have the full picture when we start judging someone. When we judge a decision that maybe a leader has made, when we judge something that a spouse has done or a kid has done, we don't have all the information, even when we think we have all the information. God has all the information. He knows all the circumstances. Only God knows the motives. He is the only one who knows the heart. Others don't know our hearts. You ever been in a conversation with someone and you're talking and all of a sudden they're telling you what you're thinking and what you're trying to express to them? You ever been in that conversation? Sometimes they might get it right. A lot of times they get it wrong. They're like, no, that's not what I was saying at all. And I'll own it. I must be communicating badly because you're misunderstanding me. What's happening there is this. A person says something or does something. We have a feeling and a response. Okay? Are you with me? Did you know that seems instantaneous? Someone says something and we feel something, right? Did you know there's a gap there? And you know what happens in that gap? We write a story. They said this. Well, this is what that means. This is what they are trying to say by that. This is their agenda. This is what they think about me. This is how they view me. And then that controls our feelings. It's what happens in the gap. It's the story that we write, not necessarily what they said, because, you know, that story could have went several different directions. And that's why it was really great when Mark told us a couple of weeks ago how we can deal with conflict. Can you please help me understand? That's to be used in that gap. When we think, oh, they just said this and I'm getting angry here. I know what they meant by that. We need to stop. Help me understand, because I might have just wrote a bad story here, and I don't want to be wrong. God knows the motives. God knows the heart. We don't even know our own hearts. Our hearts are deceitful and desperately wicked. We need to leave the judgment to God. One qualification with all of this: we're not talking about issues of personal holiness, sound teaching. We're talking about Paul and Apollos, their gifts, their abilities, and how they are doing their work, the ministry God's given them to do. If we're talking about doctrinal heresy, or we're talking about moral failure, those things have to be confronted sometimes. So don't get me wrong about that. Verse 8, Paul goes on and uses sarcasm to emphasize his point here, telling them, oh, you guys have arrived already. I wish we were as great as you. You can work that out in your small groups this week, by the way, whether sarcasm is a good thing or a bad thing. I'm not going to spend any more time on it. But in verses 9 through 13, Paul describes for the Corinthians his experience. Being a servant and a steward had not been all chocolates and roses for Paul. And in that, he's teaching them leaders will sacrifice and suffer. If you read verses 9 through 13 on your own, you'll see that he's using an image here of a Roman general winning a great battle. When a Roman general win a great battle, he would parade his army through the streets with the trophies that he had won. Sometimes that might have been heads of people, those things. And that procession was called a triumph. At the end of the parade, at the end of the triumph, there was some other people. Those that were being taken captive and being led to the arena to be eaten by wild beasts. That's the picture he's painting. And in Paul's picture there, he's saying the Corinthians, in their pride, in their arrogance, in their criticism, they were like the conquering general. And the apostles were like those captives who were doomed to die. He was saying to the Corinthians, the Christian life for them meant flaunting their privileges and boasting about their achievements. But for him and Apollos, for Paul, it meant humble service and a readiness to die for Christ. So what's in all of this for you today? You might be sitting there thinking, oh, you're talking about leaders, and I'm not a leader. I don't have to apply any of this. If that's you and you checked out way long ago, come back for me for just a minute. Come back to me for just a minute, because I got something for you here. In 1 Corinthians chapter 4, verse 16, he says, so I urge you to imitate me. Leaders are examples. Leaders are examples. Paul understood that he and Apollos were setting the example for others to follow. And if you're a leader in the house, be sure that your role is to be setting an example for others to follow. But not everyone is a leader, but everyone is following someone. And if we are to be following the example that Paul set there, imitate me. I struggle with that verse because Paul was a leader and he's saying, imitate me. That's humbling. There's times I don't want you to imitate me, right? But I hope with Paul I can say, imitate me. And if you're a leader, I hope you can say that. But everyone is a follower. So the challenge that Paul gives them is this: we are servants, we are stewards, we sacrifice, we suffer. Imitate me. Be servants of Christ. What does he want from you? What is he asking you to do? Help out. Be willing to do the menial things. I was talking to somebody at Newcomers last night, and they were talking about gifts and knowing what they should do and get involved in and everything. And they said, you know what? I decided I'm just going to do something. You know, that's what we need to do. I'm just going to serve. We need to be stewards, faithful stewards of God's grace. If you are a follower of Jesus, you have been given a great gift of grace, greater than anything that you could have ever had, and you're to steward that. Stewarding that is not hoarding it, keeping it to yourself. It is sharing it and dispensing it to other people, giving grace, sharing God's grace, but also giving them grace as a person. And we need to be willing to sacrifice and suffer. That's all part of following Jesus. He never said it was going to be chocolates and roses. One other thing leaders do in verse 17, he says, that's why I've sent Timothy, my beloved and faithful child in the Lord. He will remind you of how I follow Christ Jesus, just as I teach in all the churches wherever I go. Leaders point people to Jesus, at least in the church context. And friends, this is what unites us, Jesus. It's not about Paul. It's not about Apollos. It's not about Stan. It's not about Justin. It's not about Sharon. It's not about Mark or Bill or Joe or Jeff or John. Many of those, all of those are former pastors. All of the pastors here, both past and present, are merely servants of Christ and stewards of God's grace.